Welcome to Historians on the Record, brought to you by the Gilder-Lehrman Institute of American History. I'm Jim Basker, president of the Institute. Our mission is to promote the study and love of American history through programs such as these. Please visit us on the web at www.gilderlehrman.org to sign up for our mailing list and learn more about our resources for teachers and students.
I'm going to talk tonight, actually, about half the subject matter of my book, and that is World War II. The book is about the Depression and, therefore, inevitably, also about the New Deal and about World War II, but World War II will be my subject this evening. World War II is often referred to as the Good War, if that's not a contradiction in terms to even think of such a thing as a good war. And if I could summarize my purpose here this evening, it is to try to explain just why it's in some ways legitimate to think of it as a good war and how it got to be that way. I find, especially when I talk about this subject to younger audiences, that often they will express to me in one form or another a certain feeling of envy about the generation, the so-called greatest generation, that endured the Depression and later World War II. And I try to remind them that of all the cardinal sins, envy has a certain peculiarity. Because of all the cardinal sins, it seems to me, envy is the only one that while you're committing it, you don't enjoy it. I mean, just think of the others. Sloth. Sloth, for example. You might regret the consequences of sloth, but while you're committing the sin itself, you're kicking back and relaxing and having to worry in the world. Gluttony, again, may come back to haunt you, but while you're actually perpetrating the crime, you're having some fun. Lust, need I say more? But envy has this peculiarity that even while we're in flagrante delicto, we're not actually having any fun. So I try to tell these young people that they should suppress that emotion because no era that had to endure a depression on the scale of what happened in this country in the 1930s and then to fight a war like World War II had anything much enviable at all. Nevertheless, I do think there is some legitimacy in our folkloric memory of World War II as the good war. And the first thing I want to try to do here this evening is to describe why it is fair, I think, in the great historical scheme of things to regard it that way. And then I'll try to turn to an explanation of how it got to be that way. How the war actually was good in its consequences for American society. Now, I want to talk both about American society at home and America's role in the world and how World War II constituted a defining moment in the history of this society domestically and in the history of this country's international posture. And much of what I have to say might be summarized in a couple of remarks, one of them written in a Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of about 3 years ago, Philip Roth's American Pastoral, which I'm expecting at least some people in this room might have read. Those of you who know the book will recall that it is a fictional account of a family in Newark, New Jersey, that comes into its maturity right after World War II and then comes apart in the 1960s. But at the front end of that novel, Roth is trying to capture the mood of American society immediately after World War II. And among many excellent lines in that book, he describes that moment as the greatest moment of collective inebriation in American history, which I think, in fact, is a lyrical and poetical line, perhaps, but a perfectly accurate line to describe the self-confident, victorious, proud feeling of this country in the generation or so after World War II, a time of unprecedented and sustained prosperity, a time of unprecedented national self-confidence, and coming on the heels of the great protracted crisis of the Depression, an extraordinary moment indeed. So some of that, the elements that constituted that greatest moment of collective inebriation in American history is what I'll try to describe in a bit more detail in just a moment. The second remark that encapsulates another big piece of what I have to say is a remark actually uttered in 1945 by Winston Churchill on the floor of Parliament in London. It's a line in which he used a peculiarly 19th century form of a speech speaking about the United States. He rendered the United States as a plural noun, a common practice in both British and American speech before the Civil War, not thereafter, but Churchill in 1945, for whatever reason, resurrected this particular syntax, and he said in a speech in which he was trying to describe for his fellow members of Parliament in August 1945 the state of the world that the war had created, he said, "The United States stand at this moment at the summit of the world." The United States stand at this moment, 1945, at the summit of the world. Well, essentially what I want to do here for the next few minutes is to flesh out a bit both what Philip Roth meant about American domestic society when he described this post-war moment as the greatest moment of collective inebriation in American history, and then turn to what Churchill meant by the United States standing at the summit of the world in 1945. Now, to do this, let me take you back in your mind's eye. This is the kind of exercise that historians are fond of, a little bit of mental time travel. Back to a benchmark year, 1940, the last full peacetime year before the United States engages in World War II. And let's look first at American society at home. If we can try to recapture the scene in this society in 1940. 1940 was the 11th year of the Great Depression, which is conventionally thought to have started immediately after the great stock market crash in 1929. We can fiddle around with whether that's an accurate starting date, but for all practical purposes, 1940 is the 11th year of what seemed at that time like an endless and insoluble economic crisis. At this late date, after two full Roosevelt administrations and one failed Hoover administration, after two successive presidents had tried to come to grips with this crisis, 11 years in, still one out of every seven American able-bodied and willing workers was unemployed in 1940, 14% of the workforce. And indeed, for the decade as a whole, the decade of the 1930s as a whole, the unemployment rate averaged 17%. 14% in 1940 was its low point after 1931. The federal government in those days did not maintain what's become common to us, knowledge to us today as a poverty line, but historians have reconstructed a poverty line for 1940, and as of that date, in this retrospective analysis, in 1940, again at the end of a decade of tremendous economic calamity, 45% of all white households in the country lived below the poverty line, and 90% of all African-American households in the United States lived below the poverty line in 1940. Women, if they worked at all in this era, and a decided minority did, and an even smaller minority of women who were married, and a smaller still minority of women who had children at home under the age of school attending, if they worked at all, were confined to a handful of occupations, typically nursing, the clerical occupations, and teaching. The middle class, if we define middle class as using a good rough and ready index of home ownership as a measure of how many people could claim middle class status for themselves, in 1940, by that index, the middle class embraced about one-third of all households in the country. The great majority of Americans did not own their own homes could not really make any legitimate claim to middle-class status. This is 1940, and then comes the war. And if the word that best describes the state of this society during the Depression of the 30s is paralysis, the word that best describes what happens after December 7th, 1941, the attack on Pearl Harbor, is movement. Tremendous, unprecedented movement. 16 million men leave their homes to join the armed forces. 12 million of them are sent overseas. 15 million civilians, one out of every eight civilians, changed his or her county of residence in the 4 years between 1941 and 1945. 8 million people moved to new states altogether. We think that during the 4 years of the war, through a combination of military service and people migrating to defense industry jobs, that one in five Americans changed his or her place of residence in a 4-year span, an extraordinary churning of the great demographic cauldron of this society. My colleague at Stanford, Richard White, has described this at one point as it was as if a giant hand reached down from above and tipped the entire continent westward by lifting the eastern seaboard so that people spilled out of the Midwest and the South, especially to the Pacific Coast states, which doubled their population between the census of 1940 and 1950. California alone added about 6 million people to its population between those two censuses. 700,000 African Americans left the South during the 4 years of World War II, more than had left since 1865. In the decade as a whole, between 1940 and 1950, 1.5 million blacks moved out of the 11 former Confederate states, making the racial issue for the first time in American history a truly national proposition. So that by, let's say, to take a fairly arbitrary date, 1960, a decade and a half after the war's conclusion, by 1960, it's fair to say, I think, that this was a different country than the country that we've just briefly looked at in 1940. 1960 is the midpoint, roughly, of a three-decade-long economic expansion that stretched from World War II into the Nixon administration in the early 1970s, punctuated by a few recessions, to be sure, but the longest period of sustained economic growth in all of American history. The size of the middle class in the decade and a half after World War II doubled. By 1960, two-thirds of all Americans are homeowners, an absolute revolution in middle class status that is unrivaled in the history of this society or any other for the rapid formation or expansion of the fabled middle class. It is in this era, and it is no accident that it is in this era of tremendous economic prosperity, growth, national self-confidence, that at last this society had the courage to grasp the nettle of racial equality. And it is no accident at all, it seems to me, that it is only in the 1950s and finally culminating in the 1960s that we finally see some kind of significant resolution of what by this time was a century-old problem of racial equity. Now, the point I want to stress here about this is that how unforeseeable all of these developments would have been from the vantage point of 1940. Anyone who had stood up in a street corner in this society in 1940 and predicted that 5 years hence, not only would the Depression be completed, but that this country would be on its way toward a three-decade-long economic expansion, one that would prove to provide so much self-confidence to the country as a whole that it would at last address its greatest, longest-standing, festering social evil, which was the issue of racial inequality, that this society would create 20 million new jobs in the post-war two decades, the majority of which would be taken by women, not men, which would ignite a complete transformation in the nature of women's relationship to the economy and in the nature of the family. Anyone who would have stood up in 1940 and predicted such things on any street corner in Manhattan or any city in this country would have had a net thrown over him and would have been hauled off to some dark place never to be heard from again, which is a reminder of just how surprising history can be, because those kinds of predictions, nutty as they would have seemed in 1940, would have been precisely accurate about where this society went after 1945. Now, so small wonder, therefore, that someone like Philip Roth, writing in the late 1990s, could quite plausibly and quite persuasively describe this post-war mood as the moment of greatest collective inebriation in our history. Now, to turn to the other capsule remark that I offered you a few minutes ago, Winston Churchill's, in his description of the United States standing at the summit of the world in 1945. To turn now to the international effects of the war and particularly America's relationship to the international system. Here, if anything, the changes the war wrought in this country's international posture were even more surprising than the changes that the war wrought at home in domestic American society. In 1940, this was still, to take our benchmark year again, the last full peacetime year. In 1940, this was still a deeply and decidedly isolationist country. It was a country still haunted by the memory of its participation in World War I an intervention, our intervention in the so-called European War, which was almost universally regarded as a calamitous error. The First World War was a war, a mistake not to be repeated in that generation's estimation, in a way quite analogous, it seems to me, to the way the Vietnam War has loomed in the consciousness of a later generation as a mistake to be avoided, its repetition to be avoided at all costs. This was a country, after all, that after World War I had repudiated membership in the League of Nations as something that engendered too much international involvement, more than the country was ready for, even though the League of Nations was the brainchild of its own leader, Woodrow Wilson. It was a country that had enacted, immediately following World War I, the highest protective tariffs in its history. First the Fordney-McCumber tariff in 1922, and then the notorious Smoot-Hawley tariff in 1930, essentially making it, for all practical purposes, impossible for foreigners to sell anything into the American market. It was a country that, an isolationist country that, for good measure, had passed its first deeply restrictive immigration law in 1924, choking off free and unregulated immigration to a mere trickle, the law that made it very, very difficult, if not practically impossible, for this country to open its gates to refugees from Nazism when Nazism began to bare its face, particularly against Jews in Europe in the 1930s. This was a country that in the 1930s, the Congress of which had enacted no fewer than five formal neutrality acts, formal statutory enactments that prohibited Americans to travel on the ships of belligerent countries, to extend loans or credits to belligerent countries, to sell all kinds of items to belligerent countries, and so on. Legislation that was designed to prevent the United States from entering by back door, side door, or what have you, into another international conflict. In 1940, the year we're using as our benchmark, even after the fall of France, after France collapsed in front of the Wehrmacht in June of 1940, even at that late date, the shooting war in Europe now is well over a year old. It began in September of 1939. The shooting war in Asia, depending how you date it, is at least as old as 1937, with the so 3 years old after the Japanese invasion of China in December of 1937. At this late date, some of you might even recollect, Franklin Roosevelt went on the radio and gave one of his famous fireside chats in December of 1940, in which he laid out his basic strategy for what he thought was politically possible at this moment in terms of America's relationship to the great international conflict that we know as World War II that was already ongoing by this time. And he used a phrase that still rings down through the years in the history books and elsewhere. He said, "We must be the great arsenal of democracy." Now, just pause a moment and think about the implications of that phrase and think of some other phrasing that Roosevelt might have used but didn't. He didn't say, "We will become the sword of democracy," nor even the shield of democracy. Rather, he said, "This country will become the arsenal of democracy, the warehouse and the production plant for democracy, leaving the actual fighting to others." And indeed, at just about this moment, at about the moment he uttered the words, "We will become the arsenal of democracy," the first peacetime Selective Service Act was going into operation, been passed a few months earlier, now was being implemented. It was called the Burke-Wadsworth Selective Service Bill, passed in late 1940. It called for raising an army, all right, since the Army of the United States then numbered fewer than 200,000 personnel. And this act called for raising an army of 900,000 men. That was the ceiling that was put upon it in this legislation. The term of service of those 900,000 men was restricted to 1 year, after which they were to be fully discharged. And there was a further proviso in that legislation that no conscript, no draftee, could be deployed outside the Western Hemisphere. So this was America's response, its military response, to the war which was already a shooting war, rather hot shooting war by this time, at the end of 1940. So here we have the picture in 1940. Now again, just cast forward, or fast forward, as they did not say in 1940, to 1945, just 5 years later. Here's this isolationist, unprepared, decidedly anti-internationalist country with a minuscule armed force timidly beginning in 1940 to put together a kind of skeletal ground army of 900,000 personnel, 1 year of service, no deployment outside the Western Hemisphere. 5 years later, this same country takes the lead in founding and funding the United Nations, the successor to the League of Nations that the United States had refused to join just a short generation earlier. This country also, 1944, 1945, took the lead in creating and funding new international institutions to facilitate world trade, the International Monetary Fund to stabilize exchange rates, the World Bank to undertake the reconstruction of Europe, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade to reduce trade barriers the world over. The present-day World Trade Organization is the successor to that body. This country, which had steadfastly refused to open its doors to refugees from Hitler's Europe, in the 30s admitted about 750,000 displaced persons from Europe or refugees in the post-war decade. And just a few years after 1945, this same just recently isolationist country decided to spend $17 billion on the Marshall Plan, articulated the Truman Doctrine, and joined its first peacetime military alliance, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. And this country, which had been economically leveled in the 1930s, no kind of presence in the international economy at all, by 1945 commanded 50% of the world's manufacturing capacity, two-thirds of all the world's monetary reserves, was a net petroleum exporter. Small wonder that Winston Churchill said, therefore, that the United States stand at this moment at the summit of the world. Now, so that's a basic brief description. I've just summarized for you a couple hundred pages of my book. Done you that particular favor. That's a brief description of just how transformative the war was in terms of American society at home and abroad. And again, I want you to keep in mind how improbable these developments were against the benchmark year of 1940. Now I want to turn to a bit of explanation of how this happened. How did the United States find itself in this very fortunate position in 1945, on the cusp of a three-decade-long economic expansion, about to double the size of the middle class, about to embrace a movement for racial equality, about to transform women's relationship to the economy, about to transform the very nature of family life, about to assume an absolutely unprecedented international role? How did this happen? Now, there's an old saw about history. The saying goes that history is just one damn thing after another. I don't believe that, and indeed what keeps working historians in business is our deep conviction that it can't be understood that way. It's more complicated than just one damn thing after another. And what I intend to argue to you here in the time that remains to me is that the United States did not end up in this position in 1945 simply by accident or act of God or because one damn thing after another happened. That there were some quite deliberately taken policy decisions that brought us to this point of standing at the summit of the world and about to embrace a 30-year period of collective inebriation. Now, before I get to that, let me concede that there is at least one, you might say, fortuitous or adventitious, accidental kind of factor here that must be acknowledged, and it is quite simply geography. Or to be a little more precise, it's the intersection of geography and the state of technology, especially military technology, as of the 1940s. Because as of this moment, in the 60 years ago or so, it was true that no potential adversary, Germany and Japan to be more precise, had the capacity easily to inflict damage on this country in its heartland. Japan, of course, proved capable of inflicting some damage on the distant periphery of American territory in the Hawaiian Islands and the Philippines and out there at the tail end of the Aleutian Island chain, also occupied by Japan during World War II. But with those, I think, in the last analysis, rather trivial exceptions, geography gave this country a dispensation that was available to no other belligerent. We were the only major state that fought World War II without any serious threat of invasion or bombardment. And that was, in large measure, an accident of geography and the given state of technology. I don't want to trivialize that. It's certainly part of the explanatory mix of how we got to be where we were in 1945. But I think more interestingly, there was a series of policy decisions taken to fight a particular kind of war. And these decisions, in the end, are what brought us to the place where we arrived in 1945. Now, I want to tell this story. Again, I'm going to summarize for you, do you a second favor, several hundred pages of highly nuanced but very colorful description of these events. I'm going to try to summarize this in what I'm going to call A Tale of Three Cities. And the moral that I'm going to try to extract from this tale of three cities is how it was precisely that we got to be, how we were able to fight the kind of war we did, and how fighting that kind of war brought us to the position that we occupied in 1945. So this is just as teachers sometimes say when they're in a mood to utter $18 12-cylinder words, this is just a heuristic device. A way to try to hold in our minds some very, very complicated, but in the end, really quite consequential decisions that were made, this tale of three cities. The three cities are just, again, just mnemonic, another 18-barrel word, device to keep these things in mind. The three cities are Rouen on the lower Seine River in France. That's city number one. City number two is Washington, D.C., and city number three is a many times renamed city, once upon a time known as Tsaritsyn, later known as Volgograd, but in the period that we're talking about, known as Stalingrad. And the period we're talking about is actually quite well defined chronologically. It's about an 8-month period, or actually about a 6-month period. It stretches from August of 1942 to February 1943. In this 6-month period, a series of decisions were taken by the American political and military leadership that gave us the war that we got and the results that we got by 1945. So, what is this tale of three cities? Well, let's start with city number one, Rouen, a city that doesn't usually figure prominently in accounts of American participation in World War II. But it actually has quite an interesting history in this regard because of an event that took place there on August 17th, 1942. And that date marked the first B-17 raid by the elements of the United States 8th Air Force on continental Europe. It was a raid by a scratch force of 12 B-17 so-called flying fortresses, supposedly self-defending bombers that needed no fighter escort to go into combat because they were armed with up to 11 or 12 50-caliber machine guns that could beat away any fighter attack from the enemy. But in fact, on this occasion, and many others for that matter, this squadron of 12 B-17s was accompanied by a virtual swarm of British Spitfire fighters. A very short foray from the south of England across the English Channel, just a few miles inland into occupied France, to bomb a railroad marshaling yard in Rouen, a few hundred yards away from that famous cathedral that all those impressionists had painted a generation or two earlier. Very successful raid, no damage inflicted on the cathedral, and a fair bit of damage done to the railroad marshaling yard. Now, why is this single bombing raid important? It's important because it was the first American aerial attack on Nazi Europe, and it was the herald of the principal means by which this country thereafter carried the war to Germany, which was from the air. The air campaign begins in August 1942 against Germany and lasts against Germany until May of 1945, until the Germans surrender. And of course, once the technical means, longer distance bombers, the B-29 in particular, were available, this was also the principal way that the United States in 1945 carried the war to Japan, culminating finally, as we all know, in the greatest pair of aerial attacks ever mounted, the two atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki in the summer of 1945. The Rouen raid begins, therefore, it's emblematic for us because it represents the first strike in what was quite deliberately and self-consciously designed to be the principal means, the principal force that the United States decided to rely upon to carry the war to its adversaries. It was the highest technology form of warfare available, involving the development of thousands upon thousands of these high-tech bombers, and B-17s and B-29s in their day were very high-tech achievements indeed, dropping what eventually were the highest technical achievements of the era, the atomic bombs, about which I'll have more to say in just a moment. But when the United States faced the decision, as it did, as it began to think about a serious mobilization effort in 1941 and 1942, the decision was made to make the heaviest bet on this high-tech air arm and to make this the least cost method, least costly in terms of American lives, to carry the war to Germany. And the fascination that this country retains for air power as a device that capitalizes on our technological superiority and wages war at the least cost to our manpower, a doctrine of air power that is still very much current in policymaking circles even today, as the recent events in Kosovo have demonstrated. This is an idea that is first embraced and implemented in World War II, and the raid on Rouen is its first major operational date. So this is the first city in our tale of three cities. The second is Washington, D.C. And the date, the relevant date here, is just a couple of months later, October of 1942, to be more precise, October 6th, 1942, a far less dramatic event than the bombing of Rouen, but one that was also very consequential. It was a meeting held in the office of a man whose name is probably no longer a household word, to put it charitably, Donald Nelson, who was at that time the chairman of something called the War Production Board, the person entrusted with the overseeing the mobilization effort, and in particular, moving the American economy from a civilian peacetime basis to a military wartime basis. Donald Nelson had, before the war, been the CEO of Sears Roebuck. His experience was in the retail marketing business, and he took it as part of his brief as the chief war mobilizer to ensure that the process of military mobilization and conversion from civilian to military production did not encroach deeply on civilian standards of production or civilian standards of living. And he feared that in 1942, the rate of mobilization, the pace of mobilization, and the chaos of the attempt to shift rapidly to full-scale, wall-to-wall, full-court press military mobilization was in danger of inflicting deep damage on the civilian economy and indeed proceeding in such a chaotic and inefficient way that it would eventually be injurious to the military themselves. This dispute about just what was a sustainable pace of reconversion from civilian to military purposes and just what was the maximally efficient rate at which to proceed with mobilization, it was known at the time and has been known ever since as the feasibility dispute. And Donald Nelson argued that the current rate of mobilization, the current rate of reconversion, was unfeasible. It would be infeasible to sustain it very much longer. And therefore, the rate of mobilization had to be scaled back, and the pace of mobilization had to be scaled back. This implied, among other things, moving the date for the scheduled large-scale ground invasion of Europe, moving it forward from May of 1943, its originally scheduled date, 1 year later, to May 1944. Now, everybody in this room, I'm sure, knows that D-Day actually finally happens on June 6, 1944. There was a final last-minute delay to get one last production run of landing craft, thought to be essential for a successful amphibious assault. But implicit in Nelson's program for resolving the feasibility dispute this way was the decision to postpone D-Day by a year to 1944. Well, as you can imagine, this set off a ferocious argument between Nelson and the military mobilizers, but Nelson carried the day with the backing of the Roosevelt administration. And the decision was made to slow down the rate of mobilization, to postpone D-Day by a year, and most importantly, and most consequentially, to scale back the size of the ground force that would be mobilized when mobilization was fully completed from the original target of 215 divisions, a target which had been set in August and September of 1941 as the crisis was gathering and it was becoming evident that before very long the United States would probably be in the war. The Burke-Wadsworth Selective Service Act would have to be thrown out the window. We'd have to start all over with a much larger mobilization program. And the target set then was for a ground force, infantry and armored divisions combined, of 215 divisions. As a result of this meeting in October of 1942, the 215 division target was ratcheted back to 90 divisions. It was cut by more than 50%. And this was called at the time by the people who participated in this decision, and has been known in the history books ever since, as the 90-division gamble. To mobilize a force less than half the size of the one originally envisioned. The 90-division gamble. Now, why was it a gamble? Well, the story of the gamble takes us to our third city in this tale of three cities, and that's Stalingrad. When the original 215 division mobilization program had been set, it had been set on the premise that the Soviets, who had been invaded by the Germans, you'll remember, in June of 1941, in Operation Barbarossa, it was called on the German side, the bet was by both the British and the American military analysts that the Soviet Union would not last, that it would either be defeated in the field, it would simply succumb to the power of Blitzkrieg and the weight of the German army, or alternatively, the Russians would be so badly bloodied that they'd give up. They would cut a deal. They'd make a political arrangement with the Germans, as in fact they had done in the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact in 1939, and as indeed they'd done in the other war, in World War I in 1918, when the Bolsheviks at the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk took themselves out of the war altogether and left the Western countries to their own devices. So in the summer of 1941, the Americans decided on a 215-division mobilization program because they thought the Soviets wouldn't last. At the end of 1942, they took the gamble that the Soviets would last because they were still in the fight as of October 1942. And the clincher came, the clincher that sealed the wisdom or made the risk adequately acceptable of the 90-division gamble was the surrender of the German assault force at Stalingrad in February of 1943. Because at that point, it became evident not only that the Soviets would not be defeated in the field, they had in fact held off and defeated a large German force, but it also became evident that now the Russians were capable of passing on to the offensive, as they shortly did, and began the process in the spring of 1943 after accepting the German surrender in February, of pushing the Germans back through all the Soviet heartland in Western Russia, the Ukraine, what's now called Belarus, back into Poland, into Germany itself eventually, to the Battle of Berlin in May of 1945. So it became possible now for the United States, you might say, to fully embrace what we might call a somewhat modified but still recognizable version of the arsenal of democracy strategy, the very strategy that Roosevelt had laid out in December of 1940. So it became possible, as Joseph Stalin said repeatedly during the war, for the Americans to fight a war with their money and machines and with Russia's men, which is precisely the war that we fought. With a very high-tech air force, those were the machines, with a huge industrial economy capable of munitioning ourselves, our much smaller than envisioned force, and the Russians and the British, and eventually carrying the war to the continent of Europe only at the relatively late date of June 6, 1944. I know about the Italian campaign. That was a strategic sideshow. The real action that counted was engaging the main German force close to the industrial heartland of Germany in the Ruhr. That's the strategic logic of the Normandy attack. And it comes, you might say, in certain definition, in the war's 11th hour, just 11 months before the war's conclusion. D-Day, the Battle of Normandy, are the protracted, to be sure, but endgame of the war that has already been going on by that point for nearly 4 years in the East. Now, fighting the war this way had some very particular, quite concrete consequences for the United States, not least of all for life at home during and after the war. Again, if we take as a standard of comparison our two allies in the Grand Alliance, Great Britain and the Soviet Union, in both of those countries, the civilian standard of living decreased by nearly a third, something about 30%. Less fuel, less food, less clothing, less shelter, less transportation, less all the amenities of life that the civilian economy would normally produce in both the UK, Great Britain, and in the Soviet Union. In singular and really remarkable contrast, in this country, the civilian standard of living went up in wartime by at least 15%. People had more to eat and drink and consume and wear and so on in this country than they'd had in peacetime immediately prior to the war. This is the only country that fought World War II and managed to have more of both guns and butter, to use the economist's phrase. One illustrative example. Some of you may remember the wonderful columns and feature writings of a writer by the name of Harry Golden, whose typical signature column was a piece called Only in America. And this is an Only in America story in World War II. The third anniversary of Pearl Harbor, which is December 7th, 1944, in a marketing stratagem that only could have been hatched in the United States, Macy's department store decided to use the third anniversary of the greatest humiliation of American arms ever, Pearl Harbor, as the basis for organizing a chain-wide sale. So there was a Pearl Harbor Day sale at every Macy's store in the country on December 7th, 1944. That's an Only in America story all by itself. But the deeper point is that on that day, December 7th, 1944, roughly the time when the Battle of the Bulge is about to happen, several months after the breakout from Normandy, the war is still hot and heavy in two theaters, Europe and the Pacific. On that date, the Macy's department store chain rang up the highest dollar volume sales in all of its history down to that moment. That, too, is an Only in America story. Now, I'll give you one last summary example of the point I'm trying to make. And it is a familiar story that I'm going to tell in a slightly different pitch and register than it's conventionally told. It's the story of the atomic bombs. Now, the atomic bomb story can be told in many different ways. It's a rich, fascinating topic. It can be told as a story of great scientific accomplishment, all those virtuoso physicists gathered there at Los Alamos, one of the greatest concentrations of intellectual and scientific talent ever assembled on the planet and all of human history, who achieve all these scientific and engineering and technical breakthroughs and create this device. That's one way to tell the story, is a story of heroic scientific achievement. It can be told as well as a story of ethnic revenge, because a lot of those brilliant physicists at Los Alamos were Jewish refugees from Germany who had transplanted to this country their scientific expertise and, in a sense, were in a race to construct a weapon that would be used, as it was its original intent, against the country that had expelled them or from which they had chosen to flee in the 1930s. The atomic bomb story can also be told, as it has many times over, as a moral story or as a moral fable, a story that is offered up many times that invites us to contemplate the wisdom and the legitimacy of a kind of warfare that used all the talent and scientific know-how of a very rich and powerful country to devise a means of warfare whose essential logic was to kill civilians by the tens of thousands at a single blow. Because the atomic bombs were, as people recognized then and recognized ever since, and the successors to those bombs were and are weapons of terror, weapons of civilian mass destruction. They're called weapons of mass destruction. So the story can be told and has been told many times that way. That was why there was so much controversy, you'll remember, about the exhibit of the Enola Gay at the Smithsonian Museum just a few years ago. But I want to tell the story of the atomic bombs briefly, in yet another vein, as an economic story, which is another way to understand what happened here. The scientific basis for making an atomic weapon the scientific possibility, you might say, of putting together a fission device of tremendous destructive power was well understood in the world scientific and physics community particularly by at least 1939. And indeed, it was the fact that several émigré physicists, Leo Szilard and others, émigrés from Europe to the United States, took note of the fact that the Germans, having occupied Czechoslovakia in 1938 and 1939, had ceased the foreign export of uranium ore from the Joachimsthal mines in Czechoslovakia, one of the world's great known sources of ores of uranium. They noticed that the export of those ores had been embargoed by the Nazi regime. This was a tip-off, an absolutely clear tip-off, that the Germans were almost certainly engaged in their own project to develop an atomic weapon. And that's why they were going to hoard all this uranium raw material to themselves and not let anybody else have any. And it was that perception that led Szilard and a few others, Eugene Wigner, other refugee scientists, to compose a letter to Franklin Roosevelt for the signature of Albert Einstein, thinking that Einstein's signature would get Roosevelt's attention, the most famous physicist in the world, explaining that the Germans were almost certainly embarked on this project and the Americans better undertake their own project so that they would have a checkmate weapon to stop a possible German deployment if that moment should come. And that was the origins of the American project in 1939 when this letter went forward over Einstein's signature to Franklin Roosevelt. Now, as it happens, the first couple of years, 1940, 1941, of the American Atomic Project were years in which not much happened. There was a so-called Uranium Committee, which went to work exploring the scientific possibilities and the feasibility of a weapons project. Their operating premise was essentially to satisfy themselves that the technical requirements of actually making a usable and deliverable weapon, something compact enough to be delivered in an aircraft and so on, the technical requirements were so daunting that nobody could do it. Not the Germans, not us, not anybody else. And that was the premise they were operating on until March of 1942, just a few months after the United States enters the war. Again, for scientific and technical reasons that needn't detain us here, but it became evident to some scientists at that point that the technical obstacles were overcomable. And that, at that point, in March of 1942, the American Scientific, the Uranium Committee, recommended to the Roosevelt administration that the bomb project go ahead on a full-speed ahead basis, on a crash basis. That's when the United States decides to appropriate what ended up being $2 billion, big money in those days. Remember that just a decade or so earlier, Herbert Hoover's budget, when he became president, the entire federal budget was about $2 billion. In 1929, so to appropriate $2 billion on an experimental weapons project in 1942 was a big gamble indeed. But that gamble begins, the gamble is taken, only in March of 1942. Now, the interesting thing about that date is, and I'm again telling the economic story of the development of the bomb, that within weeks, ironically enough, within weeks of the American decision to commit $2 billion and a basket full of scientific talent, within weeks of that American decision, the Germans made a different decision. The new German Minister of Munitions, Albert Speer, when he took over in the spring of 1942, among the things that he did was to summon a meeting of the German physicists at work on Germany's atomic project, and he asked their opinion on the feasibility of what they were doing, when they could have a deliverable weapon. And they told him essentially, yes, we're plowing ahead. We might have something in 5 to 10 years. And if you want to do it any faster than that, we're going to need all kinds of resources. And the scale of resources they wanted to accelerate the German bomb program was such that Speer decided that it would soak up so much German money, raw material supply, and not least of all, the pool of available scientific and technical manpower, the knowledge base of the society, that the Germans would be incapable of sustaining a conventional war. They would have to invest everything they had in an atomic project to bring that weapon system to usable development status within a reasonable period of time. So Speer decided and ordered that the German atomic project be canceled. And that decision was made, of course, unbeknownst to the Americans, within weeks of the American decision to go full speed ahead, the Americans thinking they were in a competitive race with the Germans. Every other major belligerent had its own atomic bomb project. The Russians had one. The British had one. Eventually, they folded it into ours. And the Japanese had one. Because, to repeat, the scientific basis that holding out the possibility of a bomb was widely known. Only the Americans, however, had the economic surpluses, the money, the raw materials, the electrical generating capacity, which was a huge constraint on the others, Germany and Japan in particular, because it took enormous amounts of electricity to actually operate the process that extracted usable amounts of fissionable material from the ores of uranium. Only the United States had these huge margins and surpluses to be able to go ahead and build a bomb. So in the end, not only is this the country that develops the bomb and uses it in 1945, but in strictly in economic terms, this is the only country that had the capacity to build an atomic bomb in World War II. So the story of the atomic bomb can be taken, you might say, as a kind of summary version of the basic argument I'm trying to make here, which is that the United States knew, and the leadership of the United States knew, that the most important asset that this country could bring to bear, could put into the scales in the war against Germany and Japan, was the strength of its industrial economy. Therefore, it could afford to hold more than half of the manpower that it originally intended to put into uniform, to hold it on the home front, on the assembly lines, in the factories, building the weapons of war, particularly high-tech bombers and aerial ordnance, or aerial munitions. And that would be the way to fight the war. Now, again, this had many fruits, this strategy, not the least of which is, and I'll just conclude on this note, this spared American lives to a remarkable degree. And I'll give you, this is a grisly way to end a presentation like this, and I apologize for the grimness of it, but I'll just give you a quick measure of some of the consequences of these decisions. And these are casualty figures for various combatants in World War II. Actually, they're a little bit more refined than simple casualty figures. These are death figures. The United Kingdom, a country roughly at the one-third, maybe one-quarter the size of the United States, suffered 350,000 dead in World War II, about 100,000 of whom were civilians. China, invaded in 1937, you'll remember, lost 10 million dead in World War II, about 7 million of whom are civilians. Yugoslavia, tiny country, relatively speaking, lost 2 million dead in World War II, 1.5 million of whom are civilians. Japan lost about 3 million, about 1 million of whom were civilians. Poland, 8 million dead, 6 million of whom are civilians. Germany itself, 6.5 million dead, 1 million of whom were civilians. The Soviet Union, 24 million dead, 16 million of whom were civilians. United States, 429,000 and some dead, 6 of whom are civilians. And you didn't mishear me. I said 6, not 6,000 or 600 or 60 even, but 6. 6 is the sum total of U.S. civilian casualties in World War II attributable to enemy action. In the mainland, 48 United States. They were 6 people all killed at the same moment in the woods outside the little lumber town of Bly, Oregon, the southern part of Oregon, coastal Oregon. It was a woman named Elsie Mitchell who was the wife of a pastor in a local church, and 5 children who were with her on a Sunday school outing, and they saw a strange object in the brush, and they tugged at it to pull it out and see what it was. And as they pulled at it, it blew up. It exploded and killed all 6 of them instantly. It was a Japanese firebomb that had been suspended under a rice paper balloon and floated across the Pacific on the jet stream. The Japanese launched 9,000 of them to ignite. Their purpose was to ignite forest fires in the western U.S. Most of them were duds. This one was a semi-dud, didn't ignite a forest fire. But it was the device that claimed all 6 of the civilian U.S. mainland casualties in World War II. Now, again, there's a dispensation of geography involved in that business. But again, we should remember the decisions that were taken to fight a particular kind of war and that gave us, in the end, the good fortune to be the country that stood at the summit of the world and that was about to enter a 3-decade-long generation of collective inebriation. I'll stop there.